And if you're just joining us today, we've been looking at a word, this one unique word that the New Testament uses to describe Jesus and what happens to him when he encounters the immovable us, when he encounters people. It's that word that we translate as compassion, that it happens somewhere deep from within. It's literally translated as guts. For the ancient mind, it would have been a mystery as to what goes on inside of here. And they looked at Jesus and they said, whatever is going on with him, it must come from here. It's mysterious because he has it and we don't. And the Bible writers put this word on Jesus' lips just a couple of times. Jesus actually says it a couple of times. It's when he looks out on the crowd, when he's at the Sea of Galilee, and those are the very first ones that we studied. He looked at the crowd and he says, I have compassion for them. I want to feed them. Or he says, I have compassion for them. He told the disciples, you feed them. But he actually says it a couple of times, and then we moved on to where the Bible writer ascribed it to him. He looked at his actions and he ascribed the action to him. There was nothing else that could explain it. So because Jesus has compassion where you and I don't, on crowds and people that don't deserve it and don't act right, and we're willing to have compassion on people who we think may deserve it just a little bit, you know. The interesting thing about this word is that it's only used about 15 times, and it is never, ever ascribed to anybody outside of Christ. He's the only one that it's ever ascribed to. I want to put it back on his lips today, though, because this is the first time, it will be the first time that it comes close, that it actually comes close to being ascribed to a human. But they're not really human, because he uses it three times, and he ascribes it to a character in a parable. Parable is an interesting word. We know what parable is. Do you know what parable is? We think of them as stories. We think of them as illustrations. That's a good way to put it. But literally, the word literally means side by side. In other words, to take the parable or take the story and lay it side by side to whatever it is you're trying to figure out. In Bible study, in the study of the Bible, you're trying to figure out some grand theological concept or some grand point of doctrine. You lay that out there, and then you lay the illustration side by side, and hopefully this helps you to understand this. That's what a parable literally is, side by side. In Matthew, Jesus uses the term, if you will, the phrase kingdom of heaven. He's the only gospel writer that uses the kingdom of heaven. He uses it 26 times. And whenever he says it in Matthew, he says the kingdom of heaven is like. He's taking the like and he's laying it side by side with the reality of the kingdom. And he's helping us understand. 26 times he's trying to help us to understand what the kingdom of heaven is like. And that's what he does with his word today. He'll use it three times. He'll put it in the character, if you will, of three characters in three parables. And two of them we'll take a look at in Luke. In fact, the two of them that are in Luke are probably the most famous stories of all time. Everyone knows something about these two stories. Everyone has heard these two stories. Everyone has seen these two stories, maybe whether even they've decided they have or not, because directors have used it in plays and movies. Both of them. I'm not sure if parable is the word that we use or where we get the word parabolic from, but I like it. A parabolic antenna takes a big, broad, wide signal, and narrows it down. That's what the parable is supposed to do. The parable literally laid side by side gets you to understand exactly what he's talking about today. So in Luke 15, we're given a series of three parables. Three of them. Two of them are very short. The third one is rather long. He wants to show you who someone or something is like. And in this case, he has a particular audience. He will tell you exactly why he's telling this story. Luke 15 is where we'll be today. First three verses say, now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him. And the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling and saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. Who's he speaking to? He's speaking to the Pharisees and the scribes. Believers or non-believers? Church or unchurch? I'm going to call them the church, if you don't mind, today. I'm in one of those moods. He wants to talk to the church today. He wants to talk to the believers today. Why doesn't he have to tell the tax collectors and the sinners? They're already listening. The church is not. So he pulls these three parables out of his bag and says, he told them these parables. So now we know who he's speaking to. So we've got tax collectors and sinners, and we have Pharisees and scribes. We have non-believers, we have unchurched people, and we have believers, churched people. The unbelievers are going to listen anyway. He's wanting to speak to who? To the church. So he has them, he wants to explain something to them. Something needs to come across to the church. The first two are very quick. Very quick. In fact, what I think is interesting is that he asked them, he says, which one of you would lose one sheep and wouldn't go get it? Which is interesting because most of the Pharisees weren't, shepherds. They may have owned sheep, but they weren't shepherds themselves. But he even says, you know what? You'd go get one. If you only had 100, you'd go get one, right? And so it is the parable of the lost what? Parable of the lost sheep. He says that the shepherd leaves the 99 and he goes and he hunts him down. He hunts him down. And when he hunts him down, he picks him up, he puts him on his shoulders, and he brings him home, right? And he brings him home. That's the first one. The first one is what he said. Which one of you? And then the next one is the parable of the lost what? Of the lost coin. It's a strange one. It's strange because Jesus actually points out for women. He goes, which woman among you? And I'm not sure what that means. Nobody is 100% sure what that means. Why is the woman in charge of the coins? But we're not 100% sure. Finds that she has one coin missing out of 10. And what does she do? She tears her house apart. She tears her house apart looking for it. And when she finds it, I love this picture, don't you? When she finds it. Actually, these are from a short film that somebody produced. And actually, the coins are coins that go in her headdress. In the beginning of the film, she holds up her headdress and there's a coin missing. And she's like, But anyway, I love her face there. One. Now, the thing is that they all end with the same conclusion, the very same conclusion. When they find the sheep and when they find the coin, they say, "Rejoice with me, for I found my sheep that was lost. Rejoice with me, for I found the coin that was lost. Rejoice with me." They take that one coin and that one sheep, and they go to all their friends, and they say, "Let's have a party." They're really happy about finding these one, aren't they? Rejoice with me. Let's have a party over one. Not another 99, not another 10 coins, just what? One, and it wasn't even a gain. They already owned those, but they were lost. And now that they're found, there's a reason to celebrate. Let us rejoice. They all ended the same way. And then we're also told that because of this rejoicing, it ends the same way. It says, so I tell you, there'll be more joy in heaven over how many? One sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. And then he ends the coin one by saying, just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So it ends with the party, rejoicing over the one, and it ends laying side by side again. That same joy is felt where? In heaven. Over the 99? No. Over the 9 coins? No. Over the 1. So I think we're pretty clear after the first 2, aren't we? I think we're very clear after the first 2. I don't think we need another parable to explain the parable. And notice these 3 parables, the disciples never ask him to explain it. There are some that he tells that they immediately get out of earshot of people and say, can you tell us about this one? The wheat and the tares? We didn't get it. Which brings us to the last one. The last one he concludes. There was a man who had 2 sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me. So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had, traveled to a distant country, and there he squandered his property in dissolute living. He has 2 sons. The first son asked for his inheritance. Kind of strange, isn't it? When are you supposed to get your inheritance? After he dies. I've heard some people say that the younger son just actually looked at his old man and say, you know what? I can't even wait until you're dead. But notice what he says. Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me. I want it now. Now, fathers, what would you say? Little brat pops off at breakfast wanting his inheritance, and you're not even nowhere near being dead. What are you going to say? Yeah, you don't want to say, do you? But this father gives it to him. Here you go. I don't know what he did. He apportioned it out in cash, maybe, and just gave it to him, and the son takes off. So the first parable is known as the parable of the lost sheep. The second one is known as the parable of the lost coin. But what do we call this one? The parable of the what? Of the prodigal son. This is what we call it. As a matter of fact, I just opened up 2 Bibles. Some Bibles, not all Bibles say it, but look at it. Lost sheep, lost coin, prodigal son. Lost sheep, lost coin, prodigal, and his brother. But they say that this story is not about a lost son. It's about a what? A prodigal son. So remember that. Remember that. And let me just clarify something here. Those headings in the Bible there, you do know those are not inspired, right? Okay, I just want to let you know. I've looked at Greek manuscripts. It doesn't have a little title in there giving you a hint as about what you're about to read. But we've always known this as the parable of the prodigal son. And I hope that by the time we're done studying it today, you won't think that it's the parable of the prodigal son anymore, because it isn't. This is not the parable of the prodigal son. It's not the parable of the prodigal and his brother either. We'll get to who it's about. Who it's about. But it goes on. The son's gone. He wastes it all. He spends it all in dissolute living, it is told. And when he had spent how much? Everything. A severe famine took place throughout the country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of the country who sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. Now, sometimes we say, well, that guy was cruel. He was absolutely cruel. Think about it. He's in the famine too, isn't he? He doesn't have anything for the guy. At least he sent the guy out to the pig pen, but he's got nothing. He's in a completely, absolutely hostile environment. There is nothing he can do anymore. So he sent him out to feed the pigs. Didn't send him out to eat. Didn't give him anything. Just said, go feed the pigs. As a matter of fact, it says he gladly would have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating. But no one gave him what? No one gave him anything. Would you say that he's at the end of his rope? Would you also say that Jesus is a pretty dramatic Hollywood screenwriter, if you will? It was bad enough that the kid wasted everything, but now he throws a famine at him. You know, I mean, that's tough. We think, wow, that's harsh. That's harsh. But he's trying to get him to make a point. No one in the far country will help. He's in the far country. And I think there's a spiritual indication to being in the far country is what Jesus is what he's saying here. The problem with the son was not that he wasted the inheritance, is that he was in the where? It was in the far country. Far away from who? Far away from home. far away from the Father. That's where he is. Well, he's watching the pigs eat, and he can't stand it anymore. Something in him snaps. And I've heard people make a big thing of this. It says, when he had came to himself. And it's a Bible way of saying he's come to a conclusion. And the conclusion is this: how many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare, but here I am dying of hunger? Right? The conclusion he's come to is, he says, I'm an idiot. I'm here starving. But even my father's slaves have more to eat than I do. Now notice, the famine hasn't affected his homeland, and he knows it. I'm not sure how he knows it, but he knows it. So here's what he's going to do. I'm going to get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your what? Like one of your hired hands, like one of your servants. The Greek word there is slave, like one of your slaves. Sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? I think it does. I think it sounds like an excellent plan. Either that, or he sits there and he fights with pigs over food. So I think it sounds like an excellent plan. And it would work, too, if it weren't for one thing. We're about to run into our Greek word. And guess who has it in this parable? Guess who has the guts? Guess who is moved with compassion in this parable? The Father. You all know what's coming, don't you? He set off and he went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with what? Compassion. There it is right there. Splank needs oh my. Splank non. Splank. Guts. Insides. His insides were moved. And he was moved with compassion. And he runs out to him. And he puts his arms around him. And he kisses him. Anybody ever been kissed like that? Anybody ever just truly, truly, they have their hearts just absolutely broken, and to have somebody just lay on your neck and weep and just kiss your neck? I've had it happen. He's the one doing it. So this must have put the son back just a little bit. I don't think it was the reaction he was looking for. He's back on his heels now, but he's got a plan, and he's going to go ahead with that plan, because this doesn't include what he's about to say. This compassion, it threw me back, but I've got a plan, Father. Don't worry. I've got a plan, because he's expecting any minute the father to quit weeping on his neck and ask him what he did with his money. So he's got a plan. He wants to talk before this goes away here. I like this. I'm going to say what I got to say. He said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Father cuts him off right there. Boom. Right there. And he says, quickly. So literally, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And he yells then, quickly, he yells over the son's shoulder, bring him a what? Bring him a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. I don't know if you know it or not, but the ring seals it. He gave the one ring that he had that proved he was an inheritor. He already spent that. He gave it away, and the father's got another one waiting. When did the father have that one made? The ring seals it. The ring is who he is. The ring is who he is. And the father just said right there, welcome home, son. Not a new servant. Not a amped up, steroid-induced slave. But a what? A son. Welcome home. Plan thwarted. Servant out, son in. And then, just like the shepherd and just like the woman, did you notice that the parable ends the same way the others did? He says, let us get a fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they begin to what? It ends the same way. Lost sheep, party, celebrate. Lost coin, celebrate. Lost son, celebrate. It's just this one we have a little bit more details into the preparation that went into it. It ends the same way. But in telling so, what got me was that we ran into that word again. And the word is what changes the story. We run into that Greek word. This is the time that Jesus says it's on his own lips. It's on his heart. This is how we feel. This is it right here. It comes from within. And even the people in the story are kind of back on their heels. But here it is. He's moved with the compassion. It can't be explained. This mystery of whatever this compassion is wells up in the Father. And right now, here at the end of the story, if you think about it, it's no different than the other two. The other two end right here, right? The lost sheep, the lost coin, it ends right here. But Jesus knows that someone else is listening, right? See, right now, out of the two crowds, tax collectors and sinners, churched or unchurched, believers or unbelievers, they're all here, right? And then the other crowd, scribes, Pharisees, churched believers. See, at the end of this story right here, at the end of the other two, how do you think this crowd's reacting? Are they listening? You bet. Are they celebrating? You bet they are. Because who are they? They're the lost. What happens to the lost when they meet Jesus? They celebrate. Jesus is done talking to them. He doesn't have to say anything anymore. But there's someone else listening. And to them, it just doesn't sound quite right, does it? I know what you're saying, Lord. I know what you're saying. But you can hear it coming, can't you? See, the simplicity is confounded by complexity. The complexity is only for those who are listening from this group. The simplicity is here. The Father loves him. The Father makes him his son. He never quit being his son. He didn't even have to ask. And he put the ring back on him. He didn't ask him what he did with his money. He didn't ask him what his future plans were. He didn't ask him if he was going to do it again. He didn't ask him if he was sorry. It's pretty simple. But over here, it gets a bit more complex. We hear the gospel and something in the back of our head, something just isn't quite right. And I have that word, but. I understand he loves me. I understand he forgives me. I understand all of that. And it keeps coming. But I heard several buts in Sabbath school this morning. But. I mean, think about it. My favorite parts of the parable, my favorite parts used to be, my favorite, absolute one, when I first encountered this parable, the first time I ever preached it, my favorite part was, and when he was a long way off, the first sermon that I have that I preached on the prodigal son, I called it a long way off. How's the only way that he was to know that his son was coming if he was a long way off? He was looking for him every day. Not one amen. So am I to assume that most of us are listening over here, huh? I'm standing with you. Philip Yancey, the first time he ever told the parable in India, a young man raised his hand and stopped him. Because what he wanted to do is he wanted to tell the parable and just let it lay there and just let people react, you know, when they heard it. And this one young man raises his hand and he says, are you translating that right? And he said, yeah. And he said, why? Philip said, I've got somebody here. He's onto something, you know. Why? What do you mean? He goes, a Middle Eastern man would never run. There isn't anything more undignified for a Middle Eastern man, for a father, for a one of this stature to run. It's completely undignified. And I remember Michael telling David how undignified he was because he was celebrating that the Ark of God had come back home. And he looked at her and he said, I'll become even more undignified than this. The father celebrates. He runs. He becomes undignified. All he cares about is getting there. I've been waiting for this day. I have looked every day. But still, you stand over here and there's still something not quite right. There's just some little nagging thing in here. Yes, this is wonderful, but I'm not quite sure I belong in this celebration. I'm not quite sure I get this celebration. Isn't anybody going to talk about what he has to do next? Isn't anybody going to talk about the life he's got to live? So I'm sitting in my AA meeting, and I say, hi, I'm Greg, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm looking out the side of my eye saying, yeah, but I'm not as bad as that dude. So I begin to walk away. I'll go pray. I need to go pray about this. I need to go study some more. I need to keep going to church. It's right. It's the right thing to do. I need to keep doing what's right. I need to live the right way. It's the right way, by the way. And just as I'm allowing that doubt to allow me to begin to sneak away from that celebration because I'm just a little too uncomfortable with it, I hear Jesus' voice continue. Right? And he says, and the elder son was in the field. And when he came and approached the house, he heard music and what? And dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, your brother has come and your father has killed the fatted calf because he got him back safe and sound. The brother was in his field, in the father's field. What was he doing? What the father had him do. Yes, it's his inheritance, but we work this field. We work this every day. The brother has not left. The brother has remained home. The brother would never dream of doing what his little brother did. I didn't disrespect the dad. I remained at home. I did my duty, and it all looks good on the surface. But he's got something to say about this party. He's not happy. He's not happy at all. It says he became angry. Oops. Sorry. I don't have that. No cut and paste again. I'm sorry. He became angry. And he refused to go in. Became angry and he refused to go in. It is next. No, it isn't. Do you believe that? Verse 28. I left it out. You have to take my word for it. Verse 28 says, he became angry and he refused to go in. So he's got something to say about this party. He's not going in. He's angry. He won't even go in to say hi. Now listen, you know what? It's been 2 years since I've seen my little brother. My little brother is a royal pet. But I'd at least go in to say hi. He won't even go in to say hi. Because he has that big a problem with that party that's going on in there. That is his problem. What's interesting, though, is that his father comes out now to plead with him. His father what? Gets up, leaves the what? Leaves the party, and now comes out to what? To plead with him. I'm sorry, I didn't have that verse up there. But here's the father again. The same compassion that drove him to run to that younger son now gets him to get up to leave his own party and to come out again, to leave, to go out, to seek that which is lost, that which is outside, and he comes out to plead with the older brother. He answers his father. He says, what's going on? What's going on? He answered his father, listen, for all these years I've been working like a slave for you. I've never disobeyed your command, yet you've never given me even a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. I've worked like a slave. I've obeyed your commands. You've never given me one reason to celebrate. Did you notice that when he comes in from the field, he hears the celebration, and it's unusual enough to hear celebration that he has to ask what's going on? His son. He won't even associate himself with his brother anymore. He doesn't relate to him at all. I don't steal. I don't devour my life. I don't waste it on prostitutes. Not even close. And you're going to throw a party for him? You're going to party with him? You're going to party with the one who wandered away with your inheritance? I don't get it. I just don't. That because it all begins with a fundamental misunderstanding of the father. The younger son asked for the inheritance because he thought one day it would be his. And he was afraid that he was going to be too old to enjoy it. He thought one day it would be what? It would be his. That's what he said, right? Give me my share that one day will be mine, right? That's what he said. The son, the older brother, he believes the same thing. He stays around to work his inheritance. He said, you haven't given me anything. It begins with a fundamental misunderstanding. The older brother and the younger son both do not understand the father. And it is a fundamental misunderstanding with us too, because this is not the parable of the prodigal son. Let me share with you what the word prodigal means. It means wastefully or recklessly what? Extravagant. Giving or yielding profusely. Lavish, usually followed by or with. Lavishly, abundant, profuse. We associate this with the son because we think that he was lavish with his inheritance. He didn't give it to anybody. He didn't lavish it on anybody. He took it and he wasted it. This isn't the parable of the prodigal son. This is the parable of the prodigal father. Because what he does with his love, this group stands over here and says, you're wasting your love on this young kid. He lavishes love upon him. He lavishes abundance upon him. He lavishes forgiveness upon him. He lavishes his sonship back on him. It's the father that's prodigal. A shepherd that throws a party over one sheep, that's prodigal. That's lavishly extravagant. And this group would call it wasteful. This group was standing there when Mary busted open that bottle of nard. And they called it what? They called it wasteful. Woman throws a party over one coin? That's a waste. It's the father that's prodigal. This isn't about the sons at all. You know why it's not about the sons? Because they're both lost. They're both lost. This one went away to a far country. Where? I don't know where it was, but it was away from the father. This one stayed within the confines. He worked the fields. This one stayed in the church building, but he's far away from who? He's far away from the father. He doesn't understand him either. Both sons are lost. Both sons are going to need the father to do something. That's why this parable is the parable of the prodigal father, not the lost sons. They require the father to do something that the rest of the world says is wasteful. And the father does it. He picks up his robe and he runs. Then he leaves that party. And I want to tell you that standing in this group, and I'm with you. I'm not saying that you guys are here and I'm over here. I'm here. We're all here, aren't we? We all began to feel a little bit uncomfortable with that group over there, didn't we? We say things like, oh, that's too what? That's too easy. We're all over here. Now I want to show you my favorite part of the parable. This is now my favorite part. The father says to him, son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. If the younger son would have known that he could have it, that he had it, that it was his, he never would have had to leave. And this one, he says, you're not working for this inheritance. One day it will be yours. This became yours the day you took your first breath. The day I put that ring on your finger that said that you belong to me, this is when it became yours. There's my favorite part now. Son, you've always been with me. And everything I have is yours. But I don't work hard enough, Lord. I'm not who I should be. I fail you every day. Everything I have, son, is yours. But we got to celebrate. We have to rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and he's come to life and he was lost and has been found. But Lord, I don't feel that. And I don't feel it within me. I'm angry at him. I resent him. I stayed here with you, and I have these feelings. And the father says, everything I have is yours. I understand. Stay here. Come in. And maybe someday we'll begin to feel again. This group, they hear it and they what? They rejoice. Because there's no pretending. They know who they are. They know who they are. They knew they were tax collectors and what? And sinners. They knew that exactly. And for some reason, this Jesus likes hanging around us. And so they're always what? They're always listening. They heard the parables and they were done before the older brother even hit the stage. They were partying. They were celebrating. They were partying. And the older brother hasn't even hit the stage yet. He's standing over here. We're all standing over here thinking, well, where are they going? Everything I have is yours. And you may not feel like it right now, the father says, but why don't you come on in and let's celebrate. And let's see what happens. Laodicea is the last manifestation of the church on earth. And Laodicea has one problem. One problem. They don't feel their need. I am rich and I have need of nothing. I got everything I need. I got present truth. I got current doctrine. I can recognize the signs of the times. I've obeyed every one of your commands. I've got it all. I am rich and have need of what? I have need of nothing. Yet Jesus is standing outside that church's door, knocking, asking to be let in. Actually, the church before them, the Philadelphia church, opened up a door that no one could shut, but Laodicea seemed to shut it and lock it. Why? Because they don't know who they are. Go back to Ephesus. They lost their first love. They lost what it felt to be in this crowd. They lost what it felt that day that you knew that God loved you as you were. Or maybe somebody taught you that you needed to not be as you were in order for God to love you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But not now. Not today. You know, the first thing that he gives Laodicea is eye salve, to open up their eyes, to see that they are miserable and poor and wretched and blind and what? And naked. In other words, they're who? Gold, a spotless white robe. I love you. We just lost what it felt like. And that's okay. Because over here he stands with us saying, everything I have is yours. Why don't you come on in, join the party. You want to join the party? I do.